Welcome to the Awaken Podcast. At Awaken Church, we are passionate about wrestling with and being unraveled by the Christian scriptures. Ideally, we do this together around the table in the neighborhood of Bowness. As we see it, Jesus has invited all of us to encounter him in a diverse community and participate with him in a mission of loving our neighbors.
I'm going to invite Carrie Gladue to come forward. If you haven't been following along, Carrie Gladue works at the Simon House here in Bowness, which is a house that supports men in their journey to recovery from addiction. Carrie is going to share with us some of his story tonight, and I know we will all be moved and we will catch a glimpse of the peace of Christ. His story, I think my understanding is he went from a time of hopelessness to hope, and he witnessed the light of Christ shine in a very dark time. And I was excited to learn that Carrie became a counselor at the Simon House in 2012, and since then, the Simon House has supported over 1,100 men here in Bowness, in our neighborhood, in their journey to recovery. And so I hope that after tonight, you find yourself praying for the men at Simon House, as we as a church seek to pray for and be a light in Bowness. Carrie, when you come up, I will say I forgot to tell you, because you're behind the screen, you're welcome to take your mask off. And Carrie also wrote a book called Second Chances, and he brought a few copies tonight. So you are able to pay by e-transfer or cash or maybe check. And if you're on Zoom and you e-transfer, Sarah and Jolene will add his email into the chat box now. If you want to purchase one of the books, I have no problem delivering it to you tonight if you're in Bowness, and maybe tomorrow when you're outside of Bowness. So I think after hearing his story, that might be something we'd all be interested in. So thank you so much, Carrie. Please come and share your story with us.
Thank you for having me here tonight.
Can you hear me good?
So I always like to start with the beginning of my journey. My name is Carrie Gladue. I do work at Simon House, and I actually went through the program there myself. 9.5 years clean and sober now. So it saved my life, and it saved thousands of men's life. It's been around for about 40 years now. So it's a great program. I'm going to start always with my little story here. I always include my mom's history, because when we talk about intergenerational trauma, that's where mine started. My mom was raised in a residential school in Alberta here in Gruyard, from 2.5 years old and up until they closed in 1961. My mom never talked much about the school system or anything like that. She was always so much pain. Her own self smothering with addiction, drugs, alcohol, abusive relationships. Some of the stories, you know, that were shared regarding my mom were some pretty horrific ones, and we've all heard about them. You know, the priest taking them kids for a ride and them coming back abused, and my mom was one of those children. And he would bring her back with a bag of candy. Every kid that went for a ride with him came back with a bag of candy. And those kids, like my mom, a lot of them never made it through suicide, addiction. My mom tried to raise three kids. She had one kid prior to me being born. She was impregnated by an RCMP officer, and she was very young. And he decided that he was going to leave because it wasn't right, and he took off to another part of Canada and left my mom with this baby, which she gave up for adoption. See, they never taught kids back then. They never taught the kids anything, and most kids had very low grade level, but they're very well trained on, you know, the basic farming, yard work, cleaning. My mom did a lot of cleaning, and that's all she really knew how to do. She used to talk about cleaning the hardwood floors with a brush, and they made all the kids do that. So when my mom left there, she ended up in places such as Pinoca, mental health institutions. When I did the research on my book, I was able to have a very clear picture on why my mom was the way she is, and a lot more understanding on why I turned out the way I was. You know, she had she used to be very scared of men. Anybody, she was known as a fighter, and she would always scream. When I read her transcripts from her medical history that I was able to get at that time, and I always remember one thing that really stood out to me. Here's a young little Indian girl all alone in the world and has nobody. Right? So that was really hard for me when I sobered up and trying to learn about me and why I ended up being who I was and the things I did. I had to go back and look at all this stuff. Mom would work the streets as a prostitute to bring home food for me, my brother and sister, me being the oldest. She met my father in Fort McMurray. He was a painter, and he would paint canvas and pictures all over the place, and he would sell them back when you could do that, I guess. Right? And then I start remembering him coming home, and my mom would hide us. We had those onesies. I think they're coming back now. And she'd dress us in onesies, and we had the little flippers, but she'd run us down to the basement when he'd come home, and we'd all hide under the stairs. And he'd come screaming downstairs. He'd grab her by the hair, and he'd beat her up. And I always remember the blood all over us little kids. I was 5. My brother was 4, and my sister was 3. And we'd be pulling on my mom's leg while he'd be pulling on her hair to get up the stairs. Finally, one day, he was gone. My mom went into another relationship. There was a lot of men coming around. There was a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs. And one man come over, and he was really nice to us. He would give us a quarter. Back then, a quarter was a lot of money. We could buy candy, bags of candy, chips and pop. He treated my mom really well, and my mom was in love with him. And he would introduce us as his kids, so that was new for us. See, we never had anything growing up. We were always raised on whatever my mom could do, welfare, anything like that. So mom, finally, after a short time, the beating started with her. I remember one February cold winter, when I heard glass smash, and me and my brother and sister were locked in the basement, and it was like a dungeon down there with dirt coming out of the walls, brick on the floor, and a mattress on the floor. That was our bedroom. And we could hear my mom, "Stop, you're gonna kill me." Then we heard a smash of glass like we never heard before. And then we decided to run out, break out the little window in our basement, the little cellar window of an old house. We crawled through there in our onesies, and we met mom on the street, who was stark naked, and she was bleeding all over. You see, this guy that was so nice to her was beating her with an old Electrolux vacuum, those old ones, the pipe. We went on the street, we ran down the street with mom. She was naked, and we knocked on all the neighbors' doors. Back then, I was known by the neighbors' kids as an Indian wagon burner. All stuff I didn't know nothing about, but that's what I used to get called. I used to get picked on a lot. We did. We used to have a lot of police at our house, ambulances all the time, a lot of parties. My school was directly across the street from my house. School was a very hard place for me to go. Finally, one day, out of many, my journey started in foster care at 7 years old. My first stint at foster care, I remember that paint of institutional cover with a bunch of us boys on those old beds. I was so scared I peed my pants, and I told anyone for 2 days. Finally, my mom came and got me. She told them everything was good at home, and they let me go. The drinking, the alcohol continued on. 10 years old, I was taken again. And this time I was taken for 3 years. I wasn't allowed to see my family, my brothers, sisters, nobody. I come to the reality that it was because he killed my mom finally. That's why they weren't letting me go home. 3 years later, I'm about 12 years old now, going on maybe 12 and a half. I'm allowed to go home. Mom's alive. I was happy. I was excited. We loved our mom. She'd been through a lot. She always tried to look after us the best she could. in the best way she knew how. I started doing the drugs and the drinking because I could do anything I pretty well wanted to. There was no structure in her house. It was always survival. What we're going to get for food, food bank, all kinds of stuff. One day I walked in the door and there was a woman there standing there. I knew who she was. Another social worker. I looked at the other entrance and it was blocked. My mom was standing there. She was crying. And I said, "What are you doing, Mom? I can't go back. I knew they were there for me again." I said, "The last time it took 3 years to get me home." And the worker said, "It's okay, Carrie. Your mom needs another break." See, my mom used to cut herself lots. She was known as a cutter. She'd slash her wrists all the time. She'd overdose on pills. And the worker said to me, "Hey, have you ever went camping, fishing, anything like that? Done stuff?" You know, at that age, I should have done a lot of stuff like that, but we didn't have the means or anything to do it. So it's one of my chapters in my book. It's called The Con, and I talk about that because she conned me into going. She said she was going to take me to a safe place, and it would be for a short time. So I went along. I went to this group home with a bunch of other boys there, about the same age as me. There's about three or four of them there. An older gentleman, about 55 years old and balding. He was a worker there, social worker. They treated me good. I had 3 meals every day. I'm like, what the heck is that? Is this even real? I've got new clothes. I never had new clothes before that I can recall. I had my own room. Then one night he come in there and he started doing things to me that I really didn't understand. I was told by him if I told anybody, I would never be allowed to see my family again. I was crying. And I was saying, "I want my mom." I'd barricade myself in that room and wait for a social worker to come, and no one ever came. I'd find stuff on my bed, clothes, posters. I put for my walls, stuff just to keep me quiet. When I did the research on it later on, and I'll get into investigation here a little bit, I found out that this person had convictions going back from the 1950s for doing this to children. And this was in 1983. My suicide attempt started after that. I was known as a cutter after that. I still struggle with issues from my neck from hanging myself once. It's always to numb the pain, the drugs and the alcohol, take me away from that reality. I never knew there was a better life. I didn't know anything about where I am today that was even possible. 27 years old, I walked into the police station and I told my story. I did it. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. No guys talk about that stuff happening. My own little boy was apprehended himself. And I thought, I have to do something to stop this guy if he's still there, if he's even still alive. And I walked in the cold winter many blocks into a beat office of the police and I told my story. I was so shaky I could hardly write, but the guy said, the desk sergeant said, "Do your best." So I wrote and I looked around because I was really scared and I was watching who's coming in this office all the time. And I wrote and I took those pieces of paper, a whole stack of them. I just kept writing and I dropped them off at the front desk. He was looking at him and I started the beeline for the door. And he stopped me. "Stop," the policeman said. "You need to come here." I walked over to him and I thought I did something wrong again because that's what I was always like in my life. He said, "We need to talk to some other people about this." They arrested this fellow. He was still doing the same kind of work and they arrested him in an institution where 120 boys were that he was working with. My drug use continued heavily to the point where I only did it to try to overdose and kill myself. I was so ashamed that I brought this forward. I come forward with this stuff because who wants to talk about that? The four boys that were there at the court when I had to testify against this monster, There was only three because one had hung himself over it years before. My life after that never got any better. Federal penitentiaries. This one here is, I'm 20 years old in Drumheller Penitentiary. That's where it started. Cocaine, crystal meth, in and out of jail, in and out of relationships. One day my mom called me when I was surrounded by the police. And she said, you got to come home. Now we all know that call when someone gets a really bad call and you look at them, what's wrong? That's what it sounded like. You know when you get that call, something's wrong? You can feel it. It's a bad one. When your mom calls you and says, you got to come home. My mom never said anything like that unless she was telling me that someone I knew died. So I made it home. She sat me down on the front porch and she said, I got cancer, my boy. I'm like, come on, mom. You've told me this all your life. You're always trying to kill yourself. She goes, I got cancer. And then 3 days from now, I'm getting my kidneys taken out just to preserve my life. They gave her 60 days and she made it to December 27th. She said, I'm not going to pass away in the institution anymore and all alone. Later on, I remember that little girl all alone. So she passed away in our living room. My life of crime got worse. Crystal meth addiction is a bad place to be, and it affects people in all different ways. I was really mischievous. I picked up over 300 charges all across the province of Alberta, and I was now in Calgary facing 55 of them. And I had the realization I was never getting out of jail for a long time. When I woke up in my cell after a week, I went downstairs. I was called by my lawyer. And I went down there. I said, what's it look like? He says, well, it looks like 11 years. You got to think, I was 41 years old. I'm detoxing from a lifelong drug abuse. I was 145 pounds. I had nobody. My family was wiped out because right after my mom died, my baby sister was found dead 2 blocks away from an overdose. I had one brother left. I was a mess. And I was so hurt and I was so grieving. And when my lawyer said 11 years, it just broke my heart that I was going to die in prison. This was my destiny. I went up to my cell. I went back in my cell and I opened up this book we all are familiar with. And I read something in there. Jeremiah, know the plans I have for you. Now, I've been out in and out of jail all my life. I've read through that thing. I could never say I fully read it, but I never ever understood it. But it was talking to me. And I'm like, you know, you mean you have plans for me? This, you're going to hurt me anymore? What about all this other stuff? I started screaming at God in my cell. And I said, please give me a second chance. Just give me a second chance. People have asked me when I wrote that book, why that name? I stayed true to God because that's what happened. And I always talk about God because that's where my change happened. I'm 9.5 years clean and sober and I've never looked back. I go to jails before COVID. I can go on any unit in there with special clearance and talk to people and try to help them. That's what I'm supposed to do. That's what God has a plan for me, I believe. So I decided to write this book. From being clean and honest and getting it all out there and truthful, and it's helping people, why can't it help a bunch more? And that's where I am today. I try to live a healthy life and I hang around in healthy places, and I work in an awesome place now where I went through treatment. I got into Simon House through Calgary Drug Treatment Court program. If anyone's ever heard of that or any articles about it was a life-changing experience for lifelong criminal like myself. Gave me an opportunity and a one-shot deal for a release on 36 strict conditions. Drug test twice a week, monitored everything. And if you finish that program, you can successfully get up to a year's probation. A little better than 11 years, eh? I went for it. I was surprised. I had 3 attempts to get in there. My sentence got knocked down to a plea bargain of 7 years if I want to take it. And I just trusted God. Just wait a little while, I told my lawyer, you know. I'm telling my lawyer to pray. And he's like, we got to take this deal. I said, wait one more week. Maybe they'll accept me. By now, I'm going to chapel in the remand center. I'm doing everything. I'm hanging around with people there talking about God. I'm going to meetings, keeping myself away from all that stuff. And then I got out. I worked hard. I worked on my abuse. I never told anybody other than the police. And that time when I pointed to that old man in the courtroom. And I had 8 people come forward, tell me I've never told anybody before. So that's what I work at today, knowing that it's okay. It's okay to hurt. It's okay to love. It's okay to forgive. Faith, hope, and love. Thank you.
I just wanted to read the rest of the part in Jeremiah 29 and invite you to pray with me, to pray for Carrie and with thanksgiving for his story and for the work that he does and the men in our community whose stories we sort of got to hear tonight. So let me just read to you Jeremiah 29, verses 11 to 14. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord. I will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from the places where I have banished you, declares the Lord. I will bring you back to the place from where I had carried you. Let's pray together. God of the universe, God of Boness, to the God who enters our story not in a palace, but in a barn, to the God who showed us fully who you are on the cross, that you yourself became someone betrayed, forgotten, beaten, abused, and that in your lowly estate, you reveal to us the heart of God. I pray that as we seek you and we come to be more like you, that we would be people with listening ears and breaking hearts, that can listen to people's stories before judging them, before assuming things and jumping to conclusions. And so I pray, Father God, loving God, that your peace would be upon the men in recovery at the Simon House, and all their connections, their families, their relations. I pray for peace on Carrie, on Carrie's children. I praise you, God, that you are a God of healing. You are a God who loves children. So make us a church that would truly be a sanctuary, I pray, a safe, a place of safety, a place of refuge. I thank you for this story. I pray that this story would land deep in the soil of our heart that has been frozen, that we would remember that you are a God that meets people even in the prison cell, that declares, I have a plan, I have a hope. I pray that you be with all the folks in Boness this winter, this COVID winter season, those struggling with depression, those struggling with trauma and feelings and the temptations to medicate to make the feelings stop. I pray that we would have eyes to see. Break our hearts open for you, for your work in this community, I pray. In the name of Jesus, amen.
Oh, how a rose there blooming from tender stem has sprung. Love, Jesse's lineage coming as men. Came.
Invite